You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko manuel toko ingoa, nau mai, hari mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Theo. Whai akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with Ricardo Menendez-March about the National Party's floated idea for a rates cap on local government and the local government infrastructure crisis, and also the decision to decline seabed mining in the Taranaki. I then spoke to Elvisa van der Leyen, Waikato and Taranaki Regional Conservation Manager for Forest and Bird, about the draft decision to decline seabed mining in the Taranaki and their appeal of the Waihi North gold mine application. Theo, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Law Professor Jody Gardner on the first two cases pursued by the Commerce Commission under its unconscionable conduct prohibition.
He aha ofakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Kuwa e wareware e ahi e ana koutou, te whakorongo ki ane korero anō, hei pakahere o rukiruki mā runga I te pai, tukutuku I irirangi poho.
You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
This week, sewage swept onto the beaches of Wellington and Christchurch as the water management systems in these cities both failed. At the same time, the National Party floated their idea for a cap on council rates, the same funds that ostensibly fund those water management systems. Last week, we also saw the release of a draft decision to decline seabed mining in the Taranaki Bight, a move that had been pushed for by the Green Party. For this week's catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez-March over the rates cap, the infrastructure crisis facing councils, and the draft decision to decline seabed mining in the Taranaki.
Well, kia ora, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
I want to start us off today by talking about the proposed rates cap, the floated idea that we will cap the amount that councils can raise rates by. This has been talked about from the national government and has been lambasted by the Auckland mayor, saying that it will undermine infrastructure funding and the council's ability to achieve their aims. What's your opinion on it?
We agree with the Mayor of Auckland here, and the problem that we've got is we have chronic underinvestment in infrastructure, whether it's water infrastructure, whether it's public transport, whether it's housing and other amenities like parks and libraries for that matter. And so the rates cap, all that it does is that it makes the problem worse. It's a short-term intervention. And the government is also, for all their talk about localism, imposing something on local governments who have to make decisions on rates and investment and infrastructure that suit the needs of their local communities, which is why we oppose this move and take sides with the Auckland mayor when it comes to this issue.
For councils outside of Auckland that have seen much larger rates rises, do you feel that there's a stronger argument for limiting those increases?
No, because at the end of the day, what we have is an underinvestment in infrastructure. I think one of the ways in which the government could help alleviate the current reliance on rate increases is to partner up with local government more and co-invest in infrastructure to alleviate that pressure on local governments as well. And in New Zealand, what we've got is that as a country, central government actually contributes a lower share of resources to local government than most other countries do. And this is what we've ended up with, both passing a huge amount of responsibility to local governments, but without the necessary investment and resourcing from central government so that we can have modern public transport infrastructure, good quality community venues, accessible libraries, and all the things that we need so that, for example, we don't end up with sewage spills out in the community and with environmental impacts. So this is why the current government moves to cap rates will not address our underinvestment infrastructure, and it will likely make it worse. We need a better solution than that.
Speaking on the sewage spillage, we've seen cases like this in Auckland a couple of years ago with the collapse of the sewage system in Parnell, and now more recently, of course, we're seeing it in Wellington and also in Christchurch. Under the previous government, of which your party, the Green Party, was a coalition partner to, there was a proposed policy reform of local government's water assets. How do you feel about this all now that we see these catastrophes unfolding?
So we had a cooperation agreement with the Labour Party, which meant that we actually disagreed on quite a few things, including some of the water management stuff that the Labour Party was doing at the time. But I think, for example, if we take the Wellington example, it's a really good case study as to why we should not have left the running of our waterways to private companies and multinationals. And it's the end result of having corporations that run for profit effectively managing our assets and our infrastructure. So this, we support the inquiry that the government is putting forward, but I also think that we should broaden the scope of the conversation as to why is it that we have left so much of this critical infrastructure to be run by multinationals. On top of that, I think it showcases that we need central government to better partner up with local government to invest in infrastructure like management of waste, and the end result of not doing so will be more frequent spills like the one we're seeing in Wellington and Christchurch, and as you said, a few years ago in Auckland, which has huge impacts on our biodiversity, our natural environment, but also on people's ability to even go and enjoy a summer swim, something that we shouldn't take for granted if we continue underinvesting in the infrastructure that we need.
Yes, of course. Sorry, the Green Party was not a coalition partner, you're right. So with the councils having the responsibility to look after these assets and sometimes having to delegate that off to private companies to responsibly govern these assets, it seems like they need, or are at least calling out for, far more funding. And that's a part of what this conversation around water assets and Three Waters has really been about for a while now. Do you feel like there are ways that we could change the system so they could raise more money? Mayor Wayne Brown has talked about a bed tax for visitors. That wouldn't be funding for water infrastructure, but that's another way to get funding. But this, like many of his other proposals, has been cut down by the central government. What are your thoughts on that?
We absolutely need to raise revenue so that we can invest in infrastructure. And we also need to have a conversation about the government's austerity approach when it comes to investing in actual critical infrastructure. Like I said, what we need as well is central government to better partner up and resource local government so that we can invest in things like critical infrastructure that prevents sewage spills. And this is why the Green Party has long called for reforms that will make the richest few pay their fair share so that we can invest in all the things that we need. And this is why we also support the mayor's proposals to ensure that adequate revenue is being able to be raised, because the longer that we leave this problem unaddressed, the worse these issues will get. And things that we take for granted, like being able to actually go for a swim in the summer, are becoming less and less available. And, you know, in Auckland, more and more people are having to check before they head to the beach whether they'll be swimming in literal feces. And this is why it's critical that we have a government that supports local government and infrastructure to ensure that people can have access to clean water.
Would you prefer a system in which the central government takes more charge over these assets, or one that the local governments can be better funding themselves to look after them?
I think at this point it's important that local government is able to maintain ownership over public infrastructure, that infrastructure maintains is maintained in public hands, and that the running of it is not being left to multinationals. But like I said, ultimately, in order for us to have modern and reliable infrastructure that allows us to have things like clean water, we need to ensure that we raise the revenue and that the richest few pay their fair share so that we can actually have modern cities with not just clean water, but reliable, frequent, and affordable public transport, quality housing, and amenities like community venues and pools that people of all levels of income can access.
Awesome. Now, I just want to move on to our next topic, which was the draft rejection of the seabed mining in the Taranaki Bight. This is a big win for the Green Party. How do you feel about this?
We're stoked that pressure from community organizations, Iwi Hapu and Whanau and Taranaki, and from the Greens, has finally led to an outcome where we won't be seeing our seabed being basically decimated for the gains of a multinational corporation that simply seeks to extract resources from our oceans for private gain. This should be a wake-up call for corporations seeking to destroy our environment that they cannot just get a free pass to do so. And it is concerning to see Minister Shane Jones calling for additional powers for politicians to be the ones who get to decide these sort of interventions, as opposed to actually having input from communities on the ground and to have adequate assessment about the economic benefits and environmental impacts of things like seabed mining.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the National Party's proposed rates cap, council water infrastructure crisis, and the draft decision to decline seabed mining project in the Taranaki Bight.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This is The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen. We'll be right back after this break.
Though I know it must be the killing time. unwillingly mine. Fate up against your will, through the thick and thin, he will wait until you give yourself to him. Fate up against
you give yourself. gonk!
The event of your fever dreams is approaching.
95 BFM Drive Island with Greco Romank and CCTV.
This Friday. This room
has a We are happier than a sewer rat in a pile of slop to be unleashing the blistering CCTV and the debaucherous Greco-Romank onto Drive Island this summer. Will you come ashore?
And I got a flip.
Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside.
This Friday.
From 4 to 7 p.m. Thanks to McLeod's and New Zealand On Air.
Oh, my favourite jazz solo of all time. You know that one that's like boop it
barrel. Nah, I feel like they definitely
improvise like you guys still talking about jazz.
Yeah, just trying to work it out, man.
Do you know Grover?
Washington, Limelight, great album.
Grover from the Muppets.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Does he like jazz?
All kinds of people love jazz. The 95 BFM Jazz Show, Sundays at 12 with Blind Mango Chutney, Def Jim, Miss Dom, Francis Chan, or Dr. Mark Baines.
The 95 BFM Jazz Show, 12 till 2 p.m. Sundays, thanks to San Ray.
That is the result of His Majesty's government.
You're listening to The Wire.
Hello, and welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. If you want to, please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. At the top of the hour, I spoke to the Green Party about the draft decision declining the seabed mining project for fast-track approval in the Taranaki Bight. Another voice to the party was Forrest and Bird. They are now raising the alarm over a proposed gold mine in Waihi North. This is the last project that is open to them to push for an appeal following reforms to the fast-track approval scheme pushed through last year, which now limits who can submit their opinion to the fast-track approval scheme. I spoke to regional manager for Waikato and Taranaki for Forrest and Bird, Alvesa van der Leyen, about the developments and their opinion.
I want to start us off today by talking about the draft decision to decline the application for seabed mining in South Taranaki. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, Forrest and Bird are absolutely over the moon about this draft decision. We are conscious that there is the possibility that they could go to the Supreme Court or they might come back with the conditions modifications. But at the meantime, we are all celebrating as a collective across different organisations, local iwi and communities, because this is, you know, a really, really positive outcome for the marine ecosystem. You know, a whole ecosystem, whales, reefs that don't have a voice, and so we've all worked together over the last 10 years, over 10 years, to ensure that they are protected from these really destructive seabed mining activities. So yeah, it's an awesome outcome so far. We're really grateful that the panel actually looked at the evidence that was provided by experts, but also considered the uncertainties from the application that showed that they basically at this point didn't have enough evidence to show that they could mitigate the effects of plumes on not just the whales and the korora, the little blue penguins, but also the tiny things on the reefs that live around that whole area, living forests, basically. They looked at the evidence that there was a huge risk of smothering those reefs, but also impacting the light on phytoplankton, the ability for the phytoplankton to photosynthesize. So, you know, it's really great that they took all of that into consideration because that could have been a really huge risk of ecosystem breakdowns within that local area, but also potentially that whole wider area that is considered an internationally significant whale migration and feeding area. So yeah, that's a pretty scary thought to think that the impacts could be quite significant.
Do you know off the top of your head what kinds of whales are in the area?
I know that there's some sort of pygmy whale, but we've definitely got Maui dolphins that migrate through that whole eastern area of the North Island. you know, the monitoring of presence of whales and dolphins is quite difficult and very costly. So the evidence that was provided so far showed that there are whales and dolphins in that area. And there's a lot of different types of species of whales and dolphins that use that whole area. The ocean doesn't have fences. So there's probably a lot that we still don't know about that whole area, which, you know, I think was taken into consideration as well.
If they do push for a repeal of this decision, what will be the top of mind for Forest and Bird?
Well, we know for a fact that we will be throwing our weight behind this continuously, and we will continue working with other groups, organisations, iwi, groups like CASM have also been working really hard on this. So we want to, you know, acknowledge all the groups, and that we all have a shared vision to ensure that this project does not go ahead, and not just this application, but any future threats to the marine ecosystem.
All right, I want to move on now to talk about another application under the fast track approval scheme that has been the Waihi North Gold Mine.
Mm.
Forest and Bird is appealing the government's decision to approve it. Could you talk a bit about that? What is at risk here?
Yeah, well, Forest and Bird had three main concerns within our appeal. The first one is that some of the management plans under the conditions don't have much detail on how the impacts are going to be avoided or mitigated. So there's a lot of uncertainty in some of those conditions. The second is the risk of impacts to the frogs. We know that there are Archie's frogs, for instance, big talking issue over the last few years in Whariki Rauponga. the risks to impacts on them are very high under the current conditions, because the vibration levels from blasting actually provide for higher levels than the expert evidence supported. And then the last point that we highlighted was that their Wildlife Authority permit allows them to kill wildlife in general to build the infrastructure like the vents. And this permit is far too broad, so we want to see more specification under that permit, so as to not, you know, sort of destroy the whole ecosystem in those smaller areas.
We've seen conversation in recent years sort of throw up ideas that these mining companies are getting more liberal approval to harm local species and protected species. Do you feel like this is a contemporary change that's been happening under this current government, or is it more that we've made advancements in this area where we are protecting our, you know, native species better, and now we're taking a step back?
We can see through a lot of the legislative changes that our environmental protections are being weakened through multiple tools, legislative tools, which is very scary. We've also seen a continuous decline in funding for Department of Conservation, and also as a knock-on effect, funding for local conservation organisations and groups as well. So it's not a good sign, it's not a good look, but, you know, on the ground, our passionate New Zealanders are still working really hard voluntarily, as well as within our funding limits, to continue protecting what we have left, but also restoring areas to provide for new ecosystems, habitats, and provide corridors between larger ecosystems. So there's a lot of good stuff happening that keeps us hopeful, and we still celebrate all small, different sized positive outcomes for our native wildlife. So as much as the weakening of environmental protections is happening, there's a lot of great people on the ground continuing the good fight for our native ecosystems and species. So we've got to maintain that balance. We've got to keep that positive outlook for our unique Indigenous ecosystems, because governments change, and that's what we continue working on, what's in front of us, but also focusing on that sustainable future for our very unique nature in New Zealand.
You spoke about, you know, reforms to regulations that are undermining or failing to protect our local species. Is there any one particular that is alarming to you?
Oh, well, I mean, the key thing in this situation with the fast track is that the government changed the ability for community organisations to be actively involved in the process, to be invited for comment. So we've now been excluded from that process, and so this appeal for the Waihi North gold mine is our last chance within this framework to participate in the process of consenting for these big projects. So yeah, that's why we're throwing all our weight behind all this and ensuring the best outcome for nature, given, you know, the restrictions that we're under.
So let's talk about that in a bit more detail. You're telling me that they have removed the ability for community groups such as Forest and Bird or many others to submit on to submit their opinion on these applications?
Yeah. So the Fast Track Amendment Bill at the end of 2025 actually included an amendment that removed the obligation to invite people for comment. And there is a very narrow, I can't remember the details off the top of my head, but there's a very, very narrow group of individuals or organisations, groups to be who are obligated to be invited for comment, and community groups have now been excluded.
So who gets to decide those invitations? Assumedly, those people would be able to decide if community groups were appropriate or not to be invited, but who makes that decision at the end of the day now?
I can't remember off the top of my head, because there's, you know, you've got the convener, the panel, and then you've got the minister. And so the delegations of those responsibilities, I personally, we've got a legal team that can answer that question for you. But me, as a local advocate, I haven't been involved in all the technical details of those delegations.
Given this and given these changes, and also just given the recency of the fast track approval scheme, do you feel like it's fit for purpose?
Well, it's interesting, because over the years, previously under the COVID fast track process, Forest and Bird was a group that was obligated to be invited for comment, and then we became an optional group to be invited for comment, and now we're basically cut out of the process altogether. So slowly over time, and this is an example of the weakening of environmental protections and ensuring that nature has a voice in these processes, those voices have been whittled down. So from this point on, it doesn't feel like the system is fit for purpose in terms of protecting communities and nature. There's definitely a direction that this government is taking, but I would be hesitant to, you know, sort of explicitly describe that direction, because it's always changing. Yeah, that's as much as I've got to say on that piece.
Well, returning to Taranaki, what was the method of approach that Forest and Bird and the groups that were opposing the decision took to stop that?
Well, it's been a very collaborative approach from the beginning, from 2016. Iwi have had a very large voice working together. The local community has been strong on the advocacy and campaigning, and so we've been sort of working with our legal team has been working quietly in the background, tautoko, as a tautoko to the other groups and organisations. So I would say in general it's been very collaborative. It's been very, every group has had their strengths that we've all, and resources that we've all brought to the table to ensure that all aspects have been considered. And in terms of the environment, you know, we've had lots of different types of experts provide evidence in this process, which has obviously paid off so far. So that's excellent, excellent outcome for a collaborative approach.
Do you feel like under the new scheme, there will be avenues for you to collaborate with the people who are invited to submit on these fast track applications?
I'm not too sure on that. It's quite an uncertain framework that we're now moving into. But what I can say is that Forest and Bird and other groups will continue to collaborate and advocate and continue raising awareness across the country of these projects to try and get, you know, the best outcome for nature. So however that manifests, we'll just have to see, but we're going to continue working really hard advocating for the best outcomes for nature.
That was Waikato and Taranaki Regional Conservation Manager for Forest and Bird, Alvesa van der Leyden, about the draft decision to decline seabed mining in the Taranaki Bight and Forest and Bird's appeal of the Waihi North Goldmine application and the reforms to the Fast Track Approval Scheme, which is cutting them and other community groups out of the process. The Wire. This is Scapegrace with This Is I Am Not an Ashtray, I Am a Beautiful Tree. We'll be right back after these songs. Keep it on the B.
Your real life sugar, I can live in your dreams. around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Kerosene by Eve's Tumor, and before that, I Am Not an Ashtray, I Am a Beautiful Tree by Scapegrace. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
Ah!
The Wire.
The Commerce Commission, responsible for regulating competition and fair trading in Aotearoa, New Zealand, recently took two businesses to court over their unconscionable conduct. Among other behaviour, the businesses were found to have misled and exploited consumers and targeted particularly vulnerable customers. This is the first time that the Commerce Commission have pursued cases under this prohibition, with unconscionable conduct being added to the Fair Trading Act back in 2022. To understand exactly what unconscionable conduct entails and how future cases may play out, I spoke to Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jodie Gardner. Kia ora, Jodie. So starting off, first of all, what are the two cases being pursued by the Commerce Commission about?
Thank you very much for inviting me to talk today. The Commerce Commission is very excitingly taking two cases on unconscionable conduct under Section 7 of the Fair Trading Act. And these will be the first cases to really look at this area of law and provide confirmation about what that statute means in practice. And unconscionable conduct refers to a system or pattern of unconscionable behaviour where a business is found to engage in conduct that is considered deliberate and clearly unfair or unreasonable.
Right, so that kind of distinction of deliberate and unreasonable is kind of the qualifier that defines unconscionable here, because it seems like it could be quite a subjective sort of term.
Unconscionability is a very subjective and unclear term. And if you look at different jurisdictions across the world, you'll see that it has been interpreted very differently in the various courts. So this is why it's so interesting to have a look and see which way the courts in Aotearoa, New Zealand, want to interpret this very broad statutory provision.
Right, and the Commerce Commission has mentioned that in particular it will be looking at lessons from Australia who have a similar prohibition on unconscionable conduct. Would we expect to see our definition of unconscionable conduct lining up with theirs quite well?
In terms of the statutory provisions, there are a lot of similarities in the two different jurisdictions, but unconscionable conduct in and of itself is not defined. So it's up for each country to make a decision on what that term means in light of the standards of behaviour that are expected and allowed in that different jurisdiction. And whilst it's natural to look at our closest neighbour, Australia, and to determine the way that they have interpreted their provisions, I think it would be a lost opportunity if we didn't look more broadly at other jurisdictions, particularly Canada, but also reflect on what us as a country think is appropriate in our circumstances. And one of the big things that the courts could consider is what tikanga would say in these concepts and how to interpret unconscionable conduct in light of those concepts.
Yeah, and are there any other particular aspects of unconscionable conduct, particularly under tikanga, that you would like to see reflected in the court's judgments or decisions?
I think it's going to be really important to not just be limited by what one jurisdiction, namely Australia, has done, particularly when the big case that went to the Australian High Court, which is the apex court in Australia, was decided on a 4-3 majority, which meant that four judges of the High Court felt the behaviour was not at a threshold of unconscionable conduct. But the other three did find that it was unconscionable conduct. So you've got a very difficult decision with some very powerful and I think convincing minority decisions in there, arguing that unconscionable conduct should really be taken seriously and you shouldn't need a deliberate pattern of exploitation or specific defined vulnerability. And it can be a much more flexible approach to the provision.
Yeah, so jumping back to 2022, to when this prohibition was brought in, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of origin of it and what led to it being introduced? Were there many cases slipping through before this legislation?
Prior to the legislation, we did have equitable unconscionable conduct. So we already had a system in place under the case law to protect people from unconscionable conduct. And those elements were outlined in a case called Gustav and Macfield in 2007 as requiring a special disadvantage from the weaker party, knowledge by the powerful party of the special disadvantage, and victimisation of that special disadvantage. And that was considered, that was the law for quite a long period of time, but the statutory provisions were brought in place to give or to respond to what at the time were considered quite significant gaps that existed in the legislation and to provide a broader approach. But we haven't had any decisions that actually define what that broad approach is and how generous or limited the courts will interpret the provision. But what we do know is Section 7 of the Fair Trading Act says that a person must not engage in conduct that is unconscionable, and that this section will apply whether or not there is that system or pattern of unconscionability. So again, making it a broader test than the equitable one. And most interestingly, 7 subsection 3 says the section is not limited to any rule of law or equity relating to unconscionable conduct. So it says that this section should develop separate from the previous restrictions and elements that existed under the equitable regime from Gustav, which is why it's such an exciting case to follow and why it's really hard to predict which way the courts are going to go.
Yeah, so it really sounds like there's a lot of opportunity here to bring in some stronger rights for consumers. Have there been many opponents to this prohibition being brought in from the business community, for example?
Well, this is the first case that we're seeing. So we'll have to see how businesses respond, what the case determines, what the level is set in Aotearoa, and then how the businesses respond to that. But it's not that there has been no precedent in developing a very flexible standard of unconscionable conduct. In Canada, there was a Canadian Supreme Court case of Heller and Uber, which was where an Uber Eats driver argued that the Uber Eats downloadable terms and conditions had an unconscionable provision in there. And the Canadian courts made a very flexible determination of what unconscionable conduct means and didn't require a strict special disadvantage and didn't require the more powerful party to know and have specific knowledge of the circumstances of the individual arguing that was unconscionable conduct. And that was quite a significant movement away from the previous approaches that we had seen in Australia and in the United Kingdom. So there is precedent there, and it would be fantastic if the courts of this country would look broader and really think about what kind of society we want to live in and what business behaviours we find acceptable in our communities.
So what kind of penalties can we expect for businesses who are found to have engaged in this unconscionable conduct?
So individuals can be fined up to $200,000 and body corporates can be fined up to $600,000.
And if someone was to be experiencing what they believe to be unconscionable conduct, in particular, I saw mentioned that some of the consumers affected in these cases were particularly vulnerable customers, how can they report this kind of conduct if they don't have maybe the accessibility to legal services that more fortunate people may?
Absolutely. And this is one of the big issues we have about access to justice and ensuring that people get information and can advocate for their legal rights. I'd encourage anyone who thinks that they may have been a victim of unconscionable conduct or any other unfair sales tactics or breach of their consumer rights to contact their local community law centre, who can provide them with some further information and support about what options they have going forward.
That was Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jodie Gardner, on the Commerce Commission's first unconscionable conduct cases and the future regulatory opportunities of this legislation. We'll be right back after the song. Keep it on the B.
I was complaining, I was down in the A pregnant city with a Catholic mind. Starts those sheets for the birdhouse jail. All mescaline when the past is stale. Pale, Dublin in the rain is mine. A pregnant city with a Catholic mind. Slick little boy with a mind of Ritz. Pulling that thread for the next big fix. This. My childhood was small. My childhood was small. My childhood was small. My childhood was small. But I'm gonna be big. But I'm gonna be big. But I'm gonna be big. Well, Dublin in the rain is mine. A pregnant city with a Catholic mind. Stamps those sheets for the birdhouse jail. Palm mescaline when the past is stale. Pale, Dublin in the rain is mine. A loose ambassador for all that crime. Thread for the next big fix. This. My childhood was small. My childhood was small. But I'm gonna be big. But I'm gonna be big. My childhood was small. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. My childhood was small. But I'm gonna be big. But I'm gonna be big. But I'm gonna be big. I'm gonna be big.
What a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
That was Big by Fontaines DC, and before that, Pulled Up by Talking Heads. Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki mātou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Regional Conservation Manager for Forest and Bird, Elvisa van der Leyden, and Professor for Law at the University of Auckland, Dr. Jodie Gardner. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.